Video come to order. We do have a quorum present. After our last committee, last year we closed out minutes, but we will not have minutes. We're going to be doing some overviews, first from the Department of Health. We'd like to welcome the commissioner. Welcome to the committee. Commissioner Malcolm, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to say hello today and just introduce myself to you. I have been on the job for a month now and am drinking from the fire hose, as I'm sure you are quite familiar with in your roles. As some of you may know, I had the privilege of serving in this role a long time ago under then-Governor Ventura, and so it's really pretty special for me to get to come back to the Minnesota Department of Health, an agency whose work I respect and appreciate the impact that the health system in Minnesota, of which we are a core part, has on Minnesotans every single day. I learned so much in my prior term as commissioner, and I've learned a lot since in the experiences that I've had as a nonprofit executive and foundation person. So I look forward to working with all of you and with the our community partners, as well as the staff at the agency and our partner agencies, to keep on moving Minnesota forward to be the healthiest state we possibly can be for all. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, Mr. Chair or members, on either my background or anything you'd like to know before we turn it over to the folks to talk about the bonding request.
Do members have questions for the commissioner, or should we proceed into the presentation? Seeing no questions, I think we'll just proceed into the presentation. Thank you, Commissioner.
Great. Thank you so much for the invitation. I'd like to introduce the director of our Public Health Laboratory.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and my name is Joanne Bartkus. I am the director of the Public Health Laboratory at the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you for this opportunity to inform you about the bonding request for repairs to the MDA-MDH laboratory building. This is a joint request between the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health. I will be talking about the Department of Health side. If you have questions about ag, then I probably will have to refer you to somebody who actually knows more about their side of things. The laboratory building itself was completed in 2005. We moved in November of 2005, so a little more than 12 years ago. The building was completed in 2015 at a cost of approximately $60 million, and it houses the laboratories of both the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health. In order to support the laboratory testing done by both of these agencies, we require highly specialized facilities. Some of the features of this facility that make it unique are the types of utilities that it has, for example, water purification systems and an acid neutralization tank that neutralizes the wastewater coming out of the building before it goes into the sewer system. There's tight controls over the air handling system in the building, temperature, humidity, directional airflow, designed mostly to keep the people working in the building safe, as well as people outside the building. And, of course, there are a number of safety devices within the building, including fume hoods and biosafety cabinets, again, to reduce exposure to harmful substances. Since the building opened in 2005, we've had numerous issues controlling the building for a variety of reasons. And these problems have actually interrupted critical work, and it really impacts the speed of what we do and the efficiency of our work. One of the examples that I'll give is that shortly after we moved into the building, the air handlers went a little bit crazy, and the intake air went down, but the exhaust air did not. So the building became so negatively pressured that we couldn't open the doors, and it actually sucked the toilets dry in the bathrooms. So that's the nature of what we do and how difficult it is to get the building to function properly. So this current bonding request is for 19 point. Is there a question?
Our representative counted today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why wasn't the contractor held responsible?
The contractor, those sorts of daily adjustments are made by facilities personnel. I can't address what the conversations were with the contractors. I know people have come in repeatedly to work on the air balancing system. Later on, I'll tell you a little bit about what the proposed fixes are for the current issues. But at the time, I don't think it was maybe not appreciated that this was going to be an ongoing issue. I don't know that I have an answer because I'm not an engineer and I don't remember the specifics. But
Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So when you do the construction and you go out for the contract, it seems like that would be a natural part of what would be incorporated, that you bring in someone who knows something that you don't, and their job is to solve that problem. I guess I agree with Representative Considine that there should be some culpability on who got paid to remedy this.
Ms. Farkas, this was, I'm imagining, a recent problem, or how long has this problem gone back?
Well, there have been issues on and off since the building was constructed. I will have to defer to probably the Department of Administration to answer some of the questions that you're asking about the building itself and what went on with the contractor. I will say that this is not unique to this laboratory building. The University of Wisconsin laboratory remained vacant for like 2 or 3 years while they tried to get the air handling balanced. So there are things that are inherent to the running of the building because it's very complex. But there are some things that I can show you in a couple of slides that we did not appreciate. For example, the ductwork that is deteriorating in the building because it was galvanized steel instead of stainless steel. We did replace some of that ductwork in our clean metals lab probably about 5 years ago. Again, I can't really address what the conversations were that went on between the Department of Admin and the contractors, but that is certainly information that we can get.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Sure. So to fill you in, I'm sure you know most of this already, that the MDA and MDH laboratories play a critical role in protecting human health in a number of areas. We do testing that impacts human health in the areas of infectious disease, newborn screening, and a number of other areas, protecting the environment and actually informing, protecting our agricultural economy as well. The data generated by the MDA and the MDH laboratories is used for assessment and identification of potential problems and threats that threaten the well-being of Minnesotans. We do testing for the design and monitoring of interventions to correct problems and to inform policy development. It is essential for us to ensure that these activities are not hampered by a poorly functioning facility. And on the next few slides, what I'll do is highlight some of the work that is done by the MDH laboratory in that facility.
Thank you. Representative Schultz has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know the name of the HVAC contractor that installed it, the system, the air handling system? And if not, can you give us a list of those contractors?
Mr. Chair, I do not know that.
I'm sure Department of Admin would be able to have that available. I do know that we're beyond the warranty period for the building at this point.
One more question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Schultz.
Do we own the building or do we lease this building?
This building was, I don't know the answer to that. We lease it from the Department of Admin, so I believe it is owned by the state of Minnesota. Correct.
All right.
Keep going.
Please proceed.
All right. Thank you. I'll start with the environmental laboratory of the Department of Health. The environmental lab conducts testing on a variety of environmental matrices to help protect people from potentially harmful chemicals, including radioactive substances, pharmaceuticals, and other types of potential contaminants. Testing includes sort of routine day-to-day testing of drinking water to monitor drinking water safety of public water supplies and monitoring of other environmental samples for emerging contaminants. In the case of if there's a flooding event, we actually will test individual private wells, but typically what we're doing is looking at community water supplies. We also perform biomonitoring, which is actually looking at human the exposure of chemicals in humans. So a really good example of that is monitoring of PFC levels in people in the East Metro. And we've been able to demonstrate that the interventions that were taken a number of years ago to reduce PFCs in the public drinking water has resulted in decreased exposure in the population as well. In addition to these kinds of ongoing routine sorts of and scheduled studies, we also do testing for emergency response. We are a level one chemical terrorism preparedness laboratory, so we would provide surge capacity for the CDC in the event of a chemical terrorism event. And we also participate in a number of special investigations, so these are things that kind of come up unexpectedly. One example would be that we assessed the levels of mercury in skin whitening creams after being alerted by the Ramsey County Health Department of a potential problem. And also one of the more interesting things that we've had to deal with is an individual that was observed dumping something onto the hot food bar at a local grocery store. We actually received a sample of the cheesy potatoes from the hot food bar, and we were able to identify that the substance that was used to adulterate the cheesy potatoes and whatever else was on the hot food bar was an antidepressant that the individual apparently decided to share. And the area of infectious disease testing, we similarly conduct testing to detect, investigate, and control infectious diseases. I will point out that unlike standard clinical laboratories that you might find in a hospital, we are, while we do some primary diagnostic testing, primarily what we're interested in is population health and looking at things in aggregate. So we monitor bacteria and viruses that are looking for signs of antibiotic resistance that we need to be aware of to assess the efficacy of vaccines that we rely on to protect people. The laboratory is, you're probably aware, a key component of our foodborne illness surveillance system, detecting outbreaks such as the Salmonella typhimurium outbreak associated with peanut butter a number of years ago. We are also the only laboratory in the state that performs rabies testing. So when you see on the news that a sample's been sent to the University of Minnesota, that is technically true. They remove the animal's brains and send it to us, and we do the testing. We've been on the forefront of testing, responding to emerging infectious diseases such as Ebola virus. We were at an Ebola testing site, and, of course, the recent Zika virus outbreak. As well as reemerging diseases, you're probably aware that we did a lot of testing for measles this past year and mumps as well, and chickenpox. We had a trifecta in terms of vaccine-preventable disease outbreaks. And, of course, the ever-popular vector-borne diseases like West Nile virus, since we have a plethora of mosquitoes and ticks in Minnesota. We also test for the so-called select agents, which might be used for bioterrorism. And what you might see on this slide up in the upper left corner are people in full emergency preparedness level one suits testing a car from an individual who presented in Fergus Falls, Minnesota with inhalational anthrax. And I mention this for a couple of reasons. One is to point out that the laboratory in Fergus Falls was very quick at identifying that this could be anthrax. They were a laboratory that trained in our training facility in our MDHMDA laboratory building. And because of their rapid response, the individual was treated and actually survived this anthrax case. It was naturally occurring, determined not to be an act of bioterrorism. The other main area for the laboratory is newborn screening. We are up to over 70,000 babies from a low of about 68,000 actually during the recession. But people are feeling good and having babies again. We currently have 60 disorders on the panel. This includes 58 disorders that are screened for in our laboratory, plus two that are screened in the hospital nursery. That's hearing screening and critical congenital heart defect. Those results of those tests are reported to us, and then we do follow-up to ensure that these children are connected to services. We are adding testing for spinal muscular atrophy. We're scheduled to start screening on March 5th. In fiscal year 2017, we identified 369 infants with a treatable disorder. In addition to the screening, we work with partners in our community and family health division, as well as external stakeholders, to provide education to parents and providers on these disorders. Many of them are very rare. And we want to ensure that parents and the children and their families are aware of what we're doing, aware of the results of the screening, and that they receive timely intervention to improve the outcomes for these children. Now back to what happened with our building. This was a precipitating event to this bonding request. And so we've had ongoing issues, but the precipitating event for this one was our HVAC system failure, where the air handlers went down on I believe it was January 6th, 2014. It was in the throes of the polar vortex. When the HVAC went down, cold air was entrained into the building and froze our heating coils. And then they burst and cost us over $1 million in repairs to the building and replacement of equipment that was damaged. In response to that event, we did do a recommissioning study. The company that was hired to do this was Sebesta, which is an NV5 company. They were acquired sometime during this whole process. And the study started in 2015 and completed in the late fall of 2016. They focused on the mechanical systems, the heating, cooling, ductwork, HVAC, and electrical systems. What they found is what now has led to this bonding request. What you see on this slide, or hopefully can see, is that deteriorating ductwork that I mentioned that is rusting away and actually has duct tape on it to hold it together. That's on the second floor where the environmental laboratories are. The recommendation is that the exhaust and airflow systems be updated and repair and replace those HVAC components. The current valves in the building are pneumatic valves, and they don't interact well with the Honeywell control system. And so the goal of this is to make everything function the way it should and have the brain of the building talking to the moving parts. There is part of the request to reconfigure laboratory space to meet changing needs. This is predominantly in the Department of Agriculture space. Also, some unfinished space in the building that is going to be used, scheduled to be used as swing space during the construction, since we plan to actually work in the building while the construction is going on, so we need to have space to move things. Installation of uninterruptible power supply in all outlets. Some routine maintenance. There's, of course, broken ceiling tiles, things of that nature that need to be repaired. And then the lighting that does not meet current lighting standards. There is going to be a laboratory tour that on March 2nd, so if anybody wants to come and take a look at the building and ask additional questions, please contact Melissa Finnegan if you are interested in the tour, and I will entertain any questions.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know the cost of the first three items on that list on the last slide?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not know the answer to that. Again, that is something that we can get from the Department of Administration. I believe they have the costs broken down.
Other questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe this is one of those buildings where in order to meet with someone, you need to check in at an information desk, and then the person comes down to get you. I've found that really particularly irritating in both that building, the PCA building, the Anderson building, in that it makes really the normal business flow really inefficient. If you serve on an advisory committee or meet with a group of people, the staff have to keep getting up to leave the meeting to meet the person who couldn't find a parking spot because, of course, none of those buildings have adequate parking for the large meetings they hold. Is there that going to be addressed at all? It just feels to me like I know you need safety for certain parts of the operation there, but it requires absolutely everything in the building to be disrupted, and I'm not sure if the safety risk is that great that it requires every single person to be escorted.
Mr. Chair, that is actually more of a security than a safety requirement. We are, as I mentioned, we work with so-called select agents, and we are regulated by the Department of Select Agents at the Centers for Disease Control. And they have certain security requirements for the laboratory building. What we can probably do is we have to keep the laboratory building locked at all times. We do have conference rooms that once you get past that initial front door, people can access those conference rooms without needing a security card. What we do is for people that need routine access to the building, we do provide them with access to the administrative areas of the building. Not to the laboratory spaces themselves. So what I would recommend is if there is a need to access the building routinely, you can actually contact me and I can provide access to the building. But I don't think there's anything we can do to change the security without that would not. We have to meet our regulatory requirements for the security.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the need for security related to the lab, and but I just feel like in these buildings that we've built recently, the actual operation of them and has not really been adequately weighed in the design, and it makes them less useful. I know people who just refuse to go to state meetings because it's just so complicated to access them sometimes that they just don't feel like it's a major time sink, and that's not the purpose. We want our local government people and other stakeholders interacting regularly with our state agencies and feeling welcome.
I just had one question. From my memory, it seems that we also provide services to adjoining states. Is that true for testing for certain things? Is that correct or incorrect?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. And we are funded, for example, through the Centers for Disease Control as a vaccine preventable disease reference center. So to that extent, for example, Texas had a large measles outbreak last year, or the year before, I guess it was. And we provided testing for that. It's not something that's done routinely. If we do, it is as a reference center. We did do some emergency testing for the state of Indiana when vendor for a laboratory reagent stopped manufacturing their a particular test, and it was needed for newborn screening. So we actually had a contract with the state of Indiana to do their testing until they replaced that vendor. With the Level 1 Chemical Terrorism Laboratory, we would do testing for other states if that ever came up. We are funded through the CDC, mostly through federal grants and contracts to do this. With the Level 1 funding, what's interesting about that is that we're funded. Obviously, there's been no chemical terrorism events in the United States. The CDC provides funding for instrumentation, for staffing. We do proficiency tests and exercises. But to make sure that we have staff that are proficient in using this instrumentation, the CDC allows us to use those staff and those instruments for our biomonitoring studies. So it actually benefits the state of Minnesota, even though we haven't done had a chemical terrorism event. But if there were such an event, we would be mobilized to do testing for CDC and other states.
Okay. I do know that we have most of the Department of Health revenue is tied up with grants and federal monies and other things, and I was just not sure if we pursued that or looked at that when we were looking at bonding or for financing for our build cost for admin, but that was just a question. Any other questions? Representative Considine.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe we could have House staff look at what would be considered industry standards for some of these things. It seems to me that starting off with galvanized steel instead of stainless steel was a mistake in the beginning. And when you're building something like this, a third of the original cost 10 years later seems outrageous. Why wasn't stainless steel used to start with? If you're going to be dealing with something like bioterrorism, were there shortcuts taken in the original building? Some of this stuff just doesn't make sense to me as to why there were such shoddy construction when the building was taken on. 13 years later, we're looking at $20 million in upgrades. That just doesn't make sense to me.
All right. Maybe we have some folks on the committee, also on the bonding committee, who will chase that down for us as well. Other questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. All right, next we have Commissioner Johnson. Welcome back, Commissioner Johnson. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chuck Johnson. I currently serve as Acting Commissioner at the Department of Human Services. And thanks for the opportunity to be here to talk about the Department of Human Services bonding request for 2018. We're pleased to have the opportunity to be back and share with you what our priorities are for this bonding year. All of the priorities that we have in the governor's bonding proposal are in our direct care and treatment area, and the slide runs down direct care and treatment. For those of you obviously being on the HHS committee, are mostly familiar with what we do in direct care and treatment. But this is a 170-some facilities stretched across the state, serving 12,000 people, people with mental, experiencing mental illness, people experiencing substance use disorder, people with disabilities in various settings. And the key, I think, for us as we look at the facilities that we serve people in is that we are providing care and treatment for individuals in these facilities, and we are regulated. And so there are always standards that we need to meet in keeping our facilities up to date and ensuring that we're addressing problems as they arise in our facilities. It's critical not just to the care of the individuals, but also to being able to maintain the facilities as licensed facilities as we go forward. We have been working over the last year or so on a strategic plan for direct care and treatment, which is really focused on developing an integrated health system across what we do within DCT and pulling the pieces together and creating much more of a system focus as opposed to a siloed or individual facility kind of focus. A big piece of this is ensuring that our facility footprint will meet the needs and the core services that we're providing to Minnesotans, as you know, some of the most vulnerable Minnesotans. And that we have facilities that are up-to-date and modern and leveraging the best technology that we have in order to serve individuals. I also want to, before I launch into talking about our priorities, to thank this committee and the legislature generally for the funding for the Minnesota Security Hospital. That was a priority that we carried, I believe, since 2012. We had two phases of funding, got the second phase funded by the legislature last year in the bonding bill. That's a huge accomplishment, I think, for all of us to modernize that facility and make it more appropriate to the needs of people who are committed to our care as mentally ill and dangerous. And that work, phase one, is done, and phase two is underway now. And that phase largely deals with the renovation and remodeling of the older security hospital building. So this slide gives you some of the needs that we're trying to focus on within direct care and treatment. And the safer, more therapeutic environment is one that we've really been focused on and was very much a focus of the security hospital improvements that are in process now. We also have high acuity patients that are coming to us, and we need a safe environment both for the treatment of those individuals and for our employees who are providing the treatment and care. And that's a critical need as we go forward, and you'll see a proposal related to our Anoka Hospital that we believe is important in that respect as well. We want to remain as flexible as possible. You'll see that both in our sex offender proposal. And I think that as we go forward and consider the needs of our mental health system, we're all aware of the pressures that are on not just DHS facilities, but community hospitals and other places within the system, and flexibility that will allow us, if needed, to expand or retract capacity as the needs are being demanded. We also are very focused on the fact that many of the clients we serve are committed to us. Almost all of the clients we serve are committed to us. And we have legal commitments around both the entry of individuals into our care when that is ordered by a court, as well as getting people out the back door and back into the community when a court determines that that's where they belong. This slide lists the six priorities that the Department of Human Services have put forward for 2018. They're listed in priority order. Mr. Kitzberger and I will walk through the proposals and take any questions you have on them as we go through them. As I said before, the security hospital being accomplished is a big one off of our list. Some of these will look familiar to you. You'll also see that there's a theme across, particularly 2, 3, and 4 on this list, of really asset preservation, of really ensuring that the facilities that we have now are maintained at a standard that allows us to provide the care and treatment to individuals. The next slide shows you the six-year plan. This is part of the requirements under the capital budget planning in the legislature, and I think that the takeaway there that's different than what you saw on the last page perhaps is, and I'll talk very briefly about this, is that there may be a phase three of the sex offender proposal on the St. Peter campus if we continue to have bed pressures, particularly in the community preparation services. This also shows you what was approved over the last couple of years, and again, the security hospital being the big elephant in that room.
Commissioner, Representative Lofton has a question.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. And on your last slide, where you had kind of the goals, overarching goals, as you were looking at your facility needs and prioritizing, you know, what aspects you should address, one of the things that I thought was really missing was that person-centered language that the entire human services system is striving to go towards. And we know that while people are committed as mentally ill and dangerous, many of them, it's because they're dangerous to self. They're actually suicidal. They're not a risk to other people in the treatment facility or in the community, but they're committed because that is the challenge that they face. And the average length of time, I think, is 6 or 7 years that people stay there, and I don't see a goal of making it home-like whenever possible, because this is the long-term home of most of those people. And most of them, many of them, have not done a crime against another person. And I have noticed that as we've seen pictures of various proposals, they tend to be really highly institutional. And I know for safety reasons you have to tilt that way, but I would hope that as you move forward you really think about that and talk with your designers and incorporate that into the goals that you have. Because I actually think that a more therapeutic environment that feels home-like rather than like you're in captivity will actually contribute to success and maybe shorten that timeline to successful treatment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I think that is a good addition. I would, and that to me applies not just security hospital or sex offender program, but also to our services in group homes with people with disabilities, to the service we provide in our community behavioral health hospitals and in our care programs as well. Particularly to the, as you were addressing security hospital with the 6-year stay, that is something that we tried to design in as we were working on the remodeling of security hospital. As you said, there's a balance there because we do have patients who need to be in a more secure environment. Part of what we're creating in that, and one of these buildings is done, is new transitional buildings, which for the individuals who have progressed far enough in treatment that we're working on transitioning them back to the community, those are very much almost dormitory-like kind of settings, very homey relative to the more hospital kind of feel. And then we have facilities like Anoka that is a hospital and will look like a hospital, but people are only there for 90 days or so, not for a longer-term stay like you see at the security hospital.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the first priority for the Department of Human Services is sex offender program on the St. Peter campus, and this is phase two. Phase one was funded in 2014 to add some beds here. This, again, when we launched our St. Peter, our set of St. Peter proposals starting beginning in 2012 and been renewed multiple times over the course of different bonding cycles since then, these were the goals that we set forward for what we were trying to do on our St. Peter campus. And I think that with the MSH being funded, the first three are really on course to getting us toward the direction that we want to go in St. Peter. And now it's really that last goal around flexible capacity for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program to meet their current bed needs that continues to be the one that is most challenging for us. Mr. Chair, I think most folks are aware, but we always make the distinction that we have two different populations on the campus in St. Peter. We have the mentally ill and dangerous folks who are at security hospital, and we have sex offender program clients who are served on the lower campus in the older buildings. We still have some of the security hospital patients who are being served on the lower campus. Once the MSH phase two is done on the upper campus, those folks will move out, and then the entire lower campus will be available to the sex offender program, and we'll have that full separation of the two populations, which was our goal when we set out 6 years ago to do this. The phase two proposal for MSOP really involves creating 50 beds for program space within community preparation services. Community preparation services is a stage of treatment that courts order individuals into, and it is a lesser restrictive environment. It's on the campus, but it's not behind the razor wire, although the individuals still wear GPS and are monitored carefully in their comings and goings around campus. The proposal, that phase one that was funded in 2014 did provide 60 additional beds. We filled those beds right away. This is a proposal for 50 more beds. And as you can see on this slide, with those 50 beds, there will be additional costs in terms of the staffing of those beds with the expanded presence on the St. Peter campus.
Excuse me, Commissioner, why is that? If our census is not going up, but just where the people live is changing, why is there $11 million more in personnel costs without an appreciable increase in the number of people we're serving?
Mr. Chair, some of it is the environments in which we're serving people. We have, for example, individuals that have been provisionally discharged. Those individuals are not out of our care. We continue to pay for their care, either through having our own staff caring for them or having contracts with community providers to pay for the care for those individuals. We also continue to have two campuses, one at Moose Lake and one at St. Peter. Moose Lake campus has been drawn down some. We have some empty units up there. We have moved staff out of Moose Lake, but not to the level where it completely offsets the need for additional staffing at St. Peter.
And how many people have we provisionally discharged in the last 5 years?
Mr. Chair, we have now 21 individuals who have been granted provisional discharge orders. Nine of them are actually out in the community. The other 12 are still waiting community placements. And so those 12 are ones where we are addressing legal pressure in order to move them out back into the community, trying to find placements for them in the community.
Thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, you know, last session we had testimony from the staff up at St. Peter, and the amount of dangerous behavior that threatens them. And in one case, they showed us a video of a lady who was in a hospital in a coma. So my question is, will any of these changes that you're requesting increase the security and safety of the staff? And I think it's the upper-level treatment center that seems to have the most problems. I think there was $30,000 of some damage last year. Somebody took a leg off of a table and smashed things all over that facility. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen. Yes, that was the security hospital that I believe you got testimony on. That's where the stories that you're telling sound familiar or come from, the security hospital. That was the proposal that you funded last year, was really to address creating a safer environment for our staff as well as for the patients. And so that work is underway now. The first phase is done, so some of the we have new units in some of the buildings that have the better sight lines that allow staff to keep better track of where individuals are. Better ability to separate different types of patients, those who have higher acuity needs, maybe in crisis, from those who may have lower needs and may be able to function better with other patients around them. So that work is underway. It's not complete yet. We have to get phase two done in order to get fully to where we want to go. But we hope that will help move us into a much safer environment for our patients. I would also say our injury numbers have gone down quite significantly over the last year as well. So whether it's due to the facility, due to other work that we've been doing and the great work of our staff, but we have been working really hard on trying to improve the safety numbers within particularly the security hospital but across our whole system.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for that response. You know, I did have some people from St. Peter, employees, just touched me in the hallway here since session started, and they said there's been a change in the way that you report injuries in terms of a two-level approach, if I'm remembering right, and that's actually resulting in the lower reporting versus, I think what the example they gave me was, they can get a black eye, but that's not reported as an actual injury. You need like a broken leg or a broken arm or something of that. So because they changed the reporting, it makes it look like the injuries have actually gone down. Again, I was just given that information spontaneously. I hadn't a chance to check it out, but what's your perspective? Has the way that the injuries have been reported. Has that changed compared to into a two-tier system rather than, you know, reporting all injuries as they actually occur?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Runehagen, to my knowledge, there hasn't been a change in how we report. There are different levels of reporting of injuries. There's an OSHA reportable injury, which is, I believe, the higher standard of the two. And so we do report injuries in different categories, but I can go back and check on that. It may be that there's been some change that I'm not aware of.
Representative Runehagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, according to these two individuals, there's as many or more injuries, okay, but because of the way the reporting is, the numbers aren't actually coming to the department. So, again, I'm just giving you feedback. I'm not saying whether it's completely true or not, but that was a little bit concerning to me. So, thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Johnson, on page 5 of your presentation deck, I'm looking at the operating budget impact. And for personnel in the biennium 2021 versus 2023, there's almost a little under $5 million increase for personnel. I'm just wondering if you could elaborate on the how-to and the wherefore of that line item.
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I believe that has to do with when the facility actually comes online, that we anticipate occupancy of the facility in July of 2020. So you'd have essentially a half year of the 2021 biennium and then a full year in 2022-23.
So, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Johnson, how many people are you anticipating hiring?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I don't have the I do. I have 62 FTEs anticipated for the 50 new beds that we're building.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, 62 people and $5 million in additional labor, that's a pretty substantial per FTE salary.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, there are other costs I know within that as well. I can go back and get you a breakdown of what's in that $8.9 million and the $15.2 to show you what those costs are.
Mr. Chair, I think that should be requested by the committee, yes.
All right.
And, Mr. Chair, I will say we're providing that information. Those would be requests that would come back to this committee presumably next year or whenever if this were if this facility was moved forward in the bonding bill. This slide is a diagram of the buildings on the lower campus at St. Peter. And the buildings that are circled are the three buildings that we're proposing to do work on. The two that are kind of spaceship-shaped ones that are in the lower left there are Sunrise and Green Acres. I think those of you that have visited the campus recognize those buildings. Those are the two buildings that will be renovated for the purposes of adding more beds to the program. They were also the buildings that were renovated in 2014 to add 60 beds. So we would add 30 beds to the west wing of the Sunrise building and 20 beds in the north wing of the Green Acres building. This is space that's currently not very usable. If you've seen the new work, the new units that we built in 2014, you get a sense of the way this would look after we've completed that work. Also within the Sunrise building in the north wing, there would be renovation of what is actually now a clinical or a medical facility to modernize that and use it as the medical clinic for the St. Peter sex offender program as well. The other building that's sort of in the middle of the page there that is circled is the Tomlinson building. This is the building that is currently not being used for much, and we propose to renovate this building and use it for activity and programming for the sex offenders, particularly to have programming that's outside of the razor wire. So as this community preparation part of the program continues to grow, we need to have programming that doesn't put those individuals in the position of having to go back behind the razor wire in order to get the programming, the training, the treatment, the recreation, the chapel services, library, and so forth. That building is actually, from the work that we've done on facility condition index and evaluating all of our facilities, is in the one of the worst conditions of our various facilities, pretty close to the point where it would be considered a crisis-level building that would be as on the borderline of whether you demolish it or whether you remodel it. So we feel the remodeling would be important to move forward with.
So, Commissioner, is that a that Tomlinson, that's outside of the wire?
Mr. Chair, it is.
And that's for recreation? Is that a, does that have a pool?
Not anymore. Mr. Chair, it actually does have a pool. Part of this proposal would be to demolish the pool.
Oh.
Okay.
All right.
Pool's been filled in.
Oh.
That's correct. It's filled in, but it still is there, and there still is equipment for the pool and all the rest of it. Mr. Chair, phase one I've mentioned a couple of times for St. Peter for the sex offender program. We added 60 beds. Those beds filled up immediately after we opened up the beds. Those were completed in 2015 or 2016 were brought online. And so this is the part of building out this community preparation services that, as I mentioned earlier, we take individuals who are ordered by the court into this level of care, and it's not directly in our control as to how many of them there are. Just wanted to cover briefly some of the legal issues that are going on in the sex offender program because it is an ongoing, I think, issue that we're all watching. The most important point is at the top of the slide, and that is that the Supreme Court did not take up the appeal from the Eighth Circuit decision. That means, as it stands now, the constitutionality of the program has been upheld in the federal courts. There's some ongoing litigation. This is Carson's case. There's some ongoing litigation still with outstanding issues. There was a hearing a couple of weeks ago, and Judge Frank left to decide what issues are still alive given what the Supreme Court action and the ruling from the Eighth Circuit. And we'll look to see that probably sometime later this spring or early summer as to what additional issues have to be worked out. We really have seen a growing slowing of the number of clients who are coming in the front door relative to certainly what we had a few years ago when we would be seeing, 40, 50, 60 new clients in a year. But what we've also seen at the same time, as I mentioned a couple of times, is more individuals being ordered by the courts into community preparation services, which is the service that's provided outside the razor wire on the St. Peter campus. And so that is... Let's go to the next slide and show you. This has been the trend in the census at Community Preparation Services. In addition to this, right now we have 32 individuals who are on the waiting list for Community Preparation Services. That means that they have been ordered by a court to be moved outside the razor wire into Community Preparation Services, but they are still being held behind the razor wire because we don't have beds to put them in. As we move people out through provisional discharge or discharge, we only have one full discharge, mostly PDs. Obviously, that opens up beds, and we can move people off of that waiting list. But that waiting list is continuing to grow. I see these requests come through on a weekly basis of more individuals that courts are recommending for being moved to CPS. This is really just about meeting the needs of MSOP where it's growing. And where it's growing right now is in community preparation services. It's part about the importance of maintaining the constitutionality of the program, ensuring that we are following court orders, ensuring that we are providing different levels of care, different levels of restrictions, depending on what the individual's needs and risks are, and not having a one-size-fits-all that gets us back into trouble with the courts. And so that's the gist of what we're trying to accomplish here, is to use older buildings we have to renovate those buildings, to create additional beds for the individuals that are moving to us for additional service. And finally, as I mentioned before, if we move through phase two, depending again on what's happening with our census, where the growth is happening or not happening, we may have a phase three. The Bartlett building, which is currently houses people who are in the transitional program out of Security Hospital, Once the security hospital phase two is done, the Bartlett building will be empty and would be available for the sex offender program, again, with some renovation and reuse on our part. Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Mr. Kitzberger to walk through the next two proposals.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. Kitzberger, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dan Kitzberger. I'm with the Direct Care and Treatment Administration at DHS. As Chuck noted earlier in the presentation, priorities 2 and 3 really could be categorized as asset preservation, but due to their critical nature, we wanted to draw them out and have them as standalone proposals. Priority 2 has to do with the dietary building on the St. Peter campus. We'd like to replace the HVAC and the electrical equipment in that building. This picture is actually the temporary air conditioning unit that we used last summer to help keep that environment more climate controlled. So, as I mentioned, this is a $2.2 million renovation. This building is used to prepare meals for all of the residents and or the patients and clients on the St. Peter campus. It's about 655 clients and patients on average. So our staff are preparing 3 meals a day, about 720,000 meals annually. We have 38 FTEs who work out of this building. And it was originally constructed in 1968. It wasn't built with air conditioning at the time, and there's been minimal modernization since then. There were some exhaust and heating and ventilation installed at that time, but it's largely inadequate for the work that's done. The heat and humidity can really become a problem, especially in the summer months. It approaches 120 degrees on warmer days inside, and this is really concerning for our staff who are working in that operation. And the newer cooking and equipment that we've installed is quite a strain on the electrical system and consumes quite a bit of energy. So we're proposing to make some updates to the HVAC, and then along with that, the electrical equipment to support that. Our third priority is also asset preservation related, but we wanted to draw it out. So this is some renovations that would affect several buildings on the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center campus, replacement of the roof, and then HVAC equipment. So the roof replacement would take place on these buildings that are pictured here. These are our patient care units. They were opened in 1998. And the original roof, a membrane-type roof, is still on and has reached the end of its useful life. So we are proposing to replace that. The other buildings impacted are the Miller Building, which was built in 1951, and the Warehouse Building, which was built in 1959, and we actually used that for storage for our food service on that campus. Those are the last two buildings that are under the control of DHS. We slowly transferred buildings over to the county, and so the last transfers took place in, I believe, 2012. So these are the last two left and are actually some of the newer buildings that were left over after that transfer. We used the Miller Building for our residential chemical dependency program. And then also our central pre-admissions program, which assesses all patients that are referred to us from counties and from courts. And then we also operate some additional operations functions out of that building. And as I mentioned, the warehouse we use specifically for storage. So this is kind of a four-part project. As I mentioned, we want to replace the roofs on the patient care units. There are some mechanical penthouses that hold equipment such as air handlers and electrical components that need to be kept out of the elements, but we don't want to take up square footage inside, and they produce noise and heat, and so they were installed on top of the buildings. And the metal cladding that we used on them we found leaked, and so we had the opportunity to test out a new type of cladding on one of the units, and it worked, so we'd like to wrap the rest of the penthouses in that cladding. We're looking to install new HVAC and fire sprinkler and electrical and lighting in the Miller Building. And this will be done sort of in concert with one of the projects that Chuck will tell you about, priority number five. Once we have it all opened up, we can do that inside of the Miller building. And then a new heating system in the old warehouse storage. So we would look to start this in July of this year and would look to complete it in the fall of 2019.
Mr. Chair, I'll pick up again with priority four, asset preservation. Obviously, asset preservation, the purpose of that is to take care of the assets that we have, take care of our buildings to extend their life, and to keep ahead of problems, to do work when it's timely to do work, and not when it reaches a stage where it becomes much more extensive or starts to impact our ability to provide care. This picture is a wall of the Pexton building on the St. Peter campus, where we currently have sex offenders housed. Asset preservation, we're asking for $18.6 million for asset preservation. We have about 19% of our facility square exterior square footage that is crisis or poor condition right now, according to our index, our facility condition index. And so we're looking at trying to address those issues that are most pressing and are in the poorest condition. The great thing about asset preservation is you can start working on it right away, and we would anticipate doing that. And that the projects, of course, are many and varied and sometimes are relatively small and allow a lot of opportunities for hiring local contractors. Since 2002, we've received $26.7 million for asset preservation, but we haven't received any since 2014. Part of what happens then is when we have critical needs, we often dip into the administrative budget or the operational budget for the programs in order to address those needs, which is obviously not ideal for the intended use of those funds. Also, it's really important that when assets, when the preservation and the improvement of assets gets delayed, it just becomes more expensive. And we constantly get this from our facility people. Anytime there's a delay in something, then they have more inflation that they have to build in. And M&B has a calculator we use, and we're always seeing, well, if you wait another year, it's going to cost you this much more. And so that's an issue that we're constantly working against in terms of our ability to keep up with the needs that we have. This chart is kind of complicated. I'm not going to walk you through the entire thing, but I wanted to show it to the committee because it represents some work that not just DHS has been doing, but all agencies and state government have been doing, of doing an index of the condition of all of our facilities. And so we have 152 project count here, which is essentially 152 facilities, and you can see the range of the current condition of those facilities. And we have three that are in crisis and four that are 24 that are in poorer condition. Right now, if we have about $2.5 million worth of identified projects within that crisis framework. If we wait another 2 years, it would become, we add about $7 million more to that category. And so every year that you wait, and as assets age and as the condition worsens, the cost becomes more both because of inflation and because of further degradation of whatever we're trying to fix. As each of us know, if you have that roof that's leaking, the sooner you fix it, the less work you have to do on fixing the interior of your house where the water got in. So this on the bottom of this chart, it also shows some calculations that we're using across agencies to identify what we believe our needs are from an asset preservation standpoint. And those are based on industry standards for how you calculate asset preservation needs relative to the total value of the property that you own and the deferred maintenance calculation based on the critical condition of the different assets. So, again, I'm showing that to you to show you that across agencies we're trying to take seriously this issue of how we look at assets to ensure that we're maintaining what we have as a state and not losing those assets to degradation. Asset preservation, so Mr. Kitzberger talked about two particular asks we have on very specific needs. Asset preservation, as you know, generally works that it's money that's given to the agency, and then we work off of a list that we have. And that list can change over the course of a couple of years, depending on if our new projects become a higher priority, things that we need to address more immediately. But we did, I think, provide the committee with a list of the projects that are currently at the top of our asset preservation list. You can also see on this slide that we've categorized these in different categories and that you know, about a third of it we categorize as life, health, and safety issues that we need to address within facilities, which are obviously the most critical needs because of providing treatment and care as we do. Priority number five is at ANOCA. Mr. Kisberger referenced it earlier. This is a request to develop an admissions unit within the ANOCA Metro Regional Treatment Center, the ANOCA Hospital. This is something we did as part of the redesign of the Minnesota Security Hospital. We believe it would help a lot at AMRTC. An admissions unit is essentially a place where individuals come when they first are admitted to the hospital. When you're dealing with people who are have high psychotic needs, when they come into the hospital, often they're very unstable. Having an admissions unit allows us to treat and evaluate those individuals and prepare them better for moving into the general units. It also allows us to provide the more intensive staffing that is needed around those higher acuity patients to address their needs. This would be built within the Miller Building, as Mr. Kisberger referenced. The Miller Building is connected to the main ANOCA hospital where we have the care units by a covered hallway, which is secure. So this is a good location for us to use. It's separate from the hospital, but it's also connected, and we can move patients in a secure fashion from one building to the other. The vision here is for a unit that would be somewhat smaller than the units that we have now within ANOCA, 10 to 12 beds, probably based on acuity, and would also allow flexibility so we could use it both for crisis and for admissions. Obviously, this would also expand the scope of the number of beds that we have at ANOCA, which would also help in terms of the influx of patients we have. Part of the reason why we believe this is necessary now is because over 70% of the individuals that are coming to ANOCA and being admitted to ANOCA are coming directly from jails. And it's a population that's much different than the population that we were seeing 4 or 5 years ago at ANOCA. And it's changed the need for the treatment we need to provide those individuals and the kind of facility that we need to have to be able to effectively treat them. The last priority for DHS is Minnesota Sex Offender Program, so we kind of bookended our sex offender requests here. This one is secure assisted housing. This is actually a revised request from something we had brought forward last year, and it's the same in the sense that we're requesting essentially two 20-bed buildings that would be targeted for use for sex offenders who need assisted living level care, who are somewhat older, or those who have lower intellectual functioning, who can live outside the razor wire, who can have somewhat more freedom, but need to be in an environment where there's a certain amount of control still. And in the past requests, we had proposed building these somewhere out in the community. In this proposal, we have decided to build them on the St. Peter campus. And so that's what our proposal is, to build a couple of new buildings that would house these segments of the sex offender program on the St. Peter campus that would house about 40 individuals when they were brought up. We expect this would be done. These buildings could be completed by 2021 if they're funded this year, and they're requested for $13.9 million. This is really, as the sex offender program has changed over time, as I was talking about earlier, we have different people who are kind of falling into different groups. We have a standard population of individuals who are somewhat younger, who progress through treatment starting in Moose Lake, moving off into St. Peter or not if they're not progressing in treatment, and may stay in treatment longer before they go to the community. What we also find as we do work more and more with this population, we have the individuals who are moving to community preparation services. We also have individuals who may not be that amenable to treatment because of the age of the individual, may not be participating in treatment, but may need additional medical care that they didn't need before and are still under our commitment. And individuals who may not respond to treatment very well because of their intellectual functioning. Some of those individuals can be moved to the community. Some of them might do better in a facility like we're proposing here, which is somewhat smaller and somewhat more open than the current sex offender program, but is on the St. Peter campus and continues to have a pretty high level of security around it. So, Mr. Chair, with that, that's our presentation, and we'd stand for any questions.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Johnson. You know, on the sheet that you have with the capital budget process, you have a couple different things for the Cambridge campus. I'm just scratching my head trying to figure it out. Envelope upgrades, I don't really understand what that is, but HVAC and electrical. I'm just wondering what of the eight buildings on that campus, there's not even eight. There might be eight buildings. There's the old gymnasium that's not being used. You have the huge warehouse shop area that's not being used. You have the where the dentist facility and some administration is being taken care of. Then you have the three 16-bed cottages. I believe 2 years ago you put new roofs on them. Those are sitting empty. Just last year, one of the cottages got relicensed to be used for one bed, being staffed 24 hours a day for one bed, a total of 48 beds in that facility capable. Is this HVAC and electrical, is that for the dental section for that in the administration building, or where is, I'm seeing $4 million worth of work, and it's the facility that has one bed.
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, the unfortunate reality is we need to maintain assets whether we're using them or not, assuming that we are anticipating future use. And we would certainly hope to have a future use for this campus because, as you said, particularly those parts of the campus are quite new and in good condition, and we have been thinking about ideas of how we could use that. Most of those require operating funds. That's an issue. We have to come forward and ask for them. But we need to maintain the assets. I don't have the specifics on what buildings the work is being done on, but I can get that information for you. I don't know unless Dan has it with him. No, we can get that information for you about specifically which buildings would be worked on.
I would appreciate that because the gymnasium area, that is in very rough shape and it's not handicap accessible. The warehouse at technically, the condition of that probably should be torn down. And the dentist area and stuff, that is, I think that was built in the early 50s.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Johnson. I appreciate you're looking at asset preservation long-term in terms of what is the condition of your current stock of buildings. I was surprised that it's 152 total. Wow. But one of the things I would really like you to also do, and this probably wasn't part of the Department of Administration ask, but is to also look at the demographics long term. And we heard from your department last year that there is a changing demographic in terms of where the demand for services are and where people live. And, you know, we need to adjust to that. People want to have their family members close to them, and it's oftentimes a part of their therapeutic treatment and their ability to maintain that family connection, particularly since we don't really have transit that takes people from one part of the state to another. And so I would hope that you would also look at that and in terms of which ones should we look at over time phasing out to establish, you know, meeting new needs in new areas that are growing with population, whether it's in the regional centers in greater Minnesota or elsewhere. We're just seeing a real shift in population. We need to make that. And I've heard from my community that there's a particular concern of people of color and children of color, you know, being placed in facilities long ways from home, oftentimes not encountering other people of color, or all the staff are white, and there's no cultural sensitivity in the programming generally, and we need to step up as a state, and it's not just the metro area that this is a challenge for, it's in all parts of the state, and so as you continue your long-range planning, look into adding that into a component and sharing that with us, that would be helpful.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner Johnson, Mr. Kitzberger. Do we have anybody on the committee on capital investment? Anybody? You are? Okay. Two? Okay. We don't typically take action on specific recommendations or bills, but we do hear them and then pass along a letter to Chairman Erdahl that we've seen the projects before the committee. Any other questions? If not, we will meet tomorrow, and we will hear from DHS on IT. Thanks for coming in today and sharing the projects. We do appreciate it. With that, we are adjourned.